Hi, everybody. This episode features an interview with IPC's president and CEO, Dr. John Mitchell. I recorded this interview a little more than a week ago, and since then, several parts of the country, including California, where I live and work, has received safer at home orders or shelter in place orders, requiring all residents to stay home except for essential things like grocery shopping and medical appointments. Additionally, many businesses were ordered closed unless they were deemed essential. Most states, including California, referred to the Department of Homeland Security's CISA.gov website to determine what types of companies are essential and are not subject to the mandatory shutdown order. Much of the electronic assembly industry falls under the government's essential business category. During a conference call last week with IPC, Dr. John Mitchell offered IPC's assistance in the event your electronic assembly business is ordered to close. In this case, IPC will send information to your local authorities to enlighten them on the Department of Homeland Security's essential business categories. If that's happening to you, contact IPC. They can help. Now that we're updated, here's my interview with IPC's Dr. John Mitchell.
So, short term, the state of the industry is very good, notwithstanding the coronavirus issues that are disrupting a little bit of the supply chain. So it's still very strong. We were worried a little bit with some of the trade and tariff wars going on, how that might impact things. But other than the coronavirus, things are actually good. In the future, it's amazing. I mean, every industry in every country in every profession you can imagine is using electronics, and that's just increasing. So the opportunities for new products, for advancement, and to leverage a lot of this new, you know, from AI to 3D printing to robotics, a lot of these things, they're already in our factories. And so we're on the leading edge of the future here, you know, in terms of just about every major technology you can imagine. We're either creating it, and after we've created it, we're one of the first people to use it. And so I'm very excited about where it's going. The electronics industry, as a rule of thumb, basically grows twice as fast as GDP. And so that's not a bad industry to be in.
That's my guest, Dr. John Mitchell, next on Reliability Matters.
Welcome to Reliability Matters, a podcast for the electronic assembly industry. Each episode covers topics related to reliability, best practices, and environmentally responsible assembly techniques, with insights from experts across the electronic assembly industry. Now, here's your host, Mike Conrad.
As IPC's president and CEO, Dr. John Mitchell leads the organization's global operations and staff. Working with the IPC Board of Directors, he is responsible for assisting in the development and implementations of the board's strategic vision and aspirational goals. He joined IPC as president and CEO in April of 2012. Dr. Mitchell began his engineering career at Alpine Electric Aerospace in 1988. In 1992, he joined Alpine Electronics and became a founding member of its research company, which is credited for introducing navigation systems to the U.S. OEM market. During his tenure at Alpine, he held several positions, including Manager of Software Engineering, Director of IT, and Senior Director of Strategic Planning. In 2003, Dr. Mitchell was recruited to Bose Corporation, where he served as General Manager and Director of a new global business unit, Bose's largest ever product development initiative. Just prior to joining IPC, he served as the CEO of Golden Key International Honor Society, the world's premier collegiate honor society with more than 2 million members in more than 190 nations. Dr. Mitchell's academic credentials include a doctorate in higher education management from the University of Georgia's Institute of Higher Education, a manager of business administration from Pepperdine University, and a Bachelor of Science in Electrical and Computer Engineering from Brigham Young University. Now, here's my interview with IPC's Dr. John Mitchell. Welcome to the program, Dr. John Mitchell. Thanks for joining me today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, Mike.
My pleasure. Let's talk about IPC for a bit. IPC states its aspirational goals as standards, education, advocacy, and solutions. So let's begin with standards. I remember when I was new in this industry, we frequently referenced military standards, the old WS weapon spec 6536, MIL standard 2000A, and others. And as I'm aware of it, most of those have evaporated now, and they've been replaced by IPC standards. So what are the advantages of an industry-wide standards organization compared to a narrower, very specific standards initiative like the military had and like Bellcore had back in the day?
Yeah, so one of the advantages of having industry standards is, first, you get a lot more diversity of input, which is always a good thing. When you bring a lot of different views to a topic, you will tend to get a much better product because you end up with a lot of more data that you're able to leverage, a lot more experience that you're able to leverage. Additionally, we're able to move at the speed of industry. You know, we're trying to keep up with consumer demands as well as taking into account, the high reliability products as well that military may have been more focused on. But this way, the standards are reflecting kind of the latest technologies that are available. And so you get a couple of advantages there in terms of diversity and a lot broader impact on your standards than you might have had in just a typical military perspective, mm-hmm. as well as then you also have the opportunity of bringing in newer or fresher technology from across the globe.
Right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I'm very thankful that IPC has not adopted the old military saying, that was in the specs, which is, here's the way you have to do it. And if you want to do it any other way, it's subject to review and disapproval, which was basically saying it ain't going to happen. I think the IPC standards have kind of replaced that with, this is the way it should be done, but it's really between you and your customer, or, at the end of the day. So
yeah, you're right. At the end of the day, it is about what the customer wants. But the idea of doing standards through an association and as an industry, it gains all those things we just talked about. But additionally, you don't have to choose all of those. As a customer, you say, okay, look, 95, 98% of the work is done, but this page right here, we actually want you to do this our way. And so you don't have to create every standard from scratch. I mean, I remember when I was at General Electric, there used to be an entire wing that was just people writing standards just for that company. And now we're able to leverage everybody's stuff. And now you can have people that are focused on a particular application and say, okay, do IPC 610, but in section 6-21, instead of what it says there, do it our way. And so you can customize and not have to feel like you're building everything from scratch.
Yeah, it's also kind of a road marker. It's a stake in the ground. I was hired as an expert witness several years ago on representing a contract manufacturer who was told by their OEM customer how to do the work. And it was definitely this far from best practice as possible. And perhaps one of the mistakes the contract manufacturer made was not, standing up to the customer, but money is money. And, they wanted the job. It was a big job. And so they agreed to do things very off book, so to speak. And what really helped in the settlement of this thing was the fact that, we were able to point to IPC standards and best practices and show that there was something that was disregarded. There was a stake in the ground that one can reference. So even though they weren't following the standard, it still helped from a legal standpoint define that there were standards, they were readily available and ignored. So,
As you share that, the other thought that triggers with me is, as you're looking for, say you have a product you want to build, as you're trying to decide where to build it in the world, if people are IPC compliant, you have a common language no matter where you might build your product, because, like 610, I think is in over 20 different languages. So wherever you might build it, you can still page, 4-3 is going to look like page 4-3, whether it's
everywhere.
In English or
sure.
French or whatever language it is. So you can also have that a little bit more assurance that you and broader opportunity to find different suppliers.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's switch to education for a moment. IPC is well known for its educational efforts. This is a subject close to my heart because I sincerely believe that educated consumers make educated choices, which is part of the reason for this podcast and the other educational efforts that we make. there's not a lot of industries that change at the rate of the electronics industry. You said earlier the speed of industry, which is I like that phrase. How does IPC stay on top of the latest industry trends and challenges and emerging technologies and everything that goes with the electronics industry?
Yeah, so our education programs have been in existence for decades now. And we partner with training centers where they will provide instruction and we certify to the on the exams. But you're right, things are constantly changing. And the way that IPC education strives to make sure that our information is the latest it can be is we utilize something that we call JTAs, Job Task Analysis Committees. And these are really industry members who are actually doing the work. So IPC, while we might shepherd this process, same as the standards, we don't generate the content. We actually look to industry to generate that content. And it's really the people who are building the stuff. It's your the actual companies that are making the stuff that provide us the best input as far as what they need in terms of education. Because when they hire somebody or bring somebody new in, they know best what kind of information they need to transfer there. And IPC, you know, as tight as we are with the industry, we're not quite as tight as being on the front line. And so that's why we work with these companies from across the globe to really understand what is it that a new operator needs? What is it that a new engineer needs? What is it that they need to understand about the standard in terms of to help them better complete their job? And so it's a constantly evolving process. We have a team that's always listening to the industry saying, okay, where are your gaps? What are the jobs you can't find to fill? All right, let's form a group that's focused on building a curriculum so that we can bring people who don't necessarily have that expertise and start them on the path, or that we can enhance that expertise, you know, a position where, you know, say you've been a line supervisor for a while and now suddenly you've moved into management. What do I do now? And so there's programs around that as well. So the way we stay up to date is by constantly working with industry to refresh or create new programs that will meet those needs.
Sure. And it is somewhat self-regulating because if the industry is writing the standard and creating the educational curriculum, so to speak, shepherded by IPC, there has to be checks in place to make sure that, you know, the standard doesn't say thou shalt use an Acme model 125 available now for $99.95. If you call in the next hour, we'll double your order. Yeah, I mean, you got to make sure the commercialism doesn't seep into that, right? So how do you avoid that? I know everyone, even if they're not trying to be commercial, I can go through a standard and I know people enough in this industry. I can kind of guess, oh, I know who wrote that. That's a
who put that piece in there.
I know who put
that
piece in there. And that's not commercial. That's I just know the person's style or you know what their frame of reference is or you know what their cause celeb is. So how do you make sure that everything is sanitized to the point where it is best practice but not self-serving,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah, so there is a review process. So even after it's created, so often we'll use something we call A-teams, where we'll take a smaller group because you can get the product, you know, maybe 80 or 90% there. And then you go through the review to flesh it out. But that during that review piece, and this is true of both standards as well as education, where the entire industry is allowed to commit or comment or put, raise issues about any particular standard. And the same type of thing goes with education as well. Specific callouts, unless there is nothing else in the world, but even then we try to genericize it, if you will. Is that even a word? I don't know.
I make up words all the time in this podcast. So this is a free word podcast.
We try to keep it, as you said, sanitized as we possibly can. And the industry does that review as well, because frankly, they can smell that a little bit more readily than just about anybody else. It's like, hey, wait a second. If I do this, and so they'll put in a comment. We can't really call that out as well.
Yeah. I guess when you have enough people, that kind of balances everything out, right? It clips the loudest and raises the softest, and you get kind of an average there. Let's talk about advocacy for a moment. I kind of always been aware that IPC does some level of advocacy, but I really haven't seen it as pronounced as I have in just the last year or so. Probably a statement of, you know, what's going on in our political system and trade deals and things like that. But I've read several articles about IPC's advocacy initiatives. And what are the most pertinent advocacy efforts that IPC is taking up today?
So there's several.
I imagine.
So part of the reason you're probably hearing more is we've put more of a focus on it. When I joined IPC, I guess it's almost 8 years ago now, as I sat with the board and we talked about, you know, directions of it, advocacy was always listed in its mission statement, but it was about three levels below the CEO. And so it was like a report to a manager, as a manager reporting to a director, reporting to a vice president, reporting to the CEO type of thing. And we elevated that presence. So I ended up hiring a government relations vice president. Our current global government relations vice president, Chris Mitchell, has done an amazing job. And, you know, from getting members literally into the White House, meeting the president, to going to the European Union and making commitments there with various parliament members, et cetera. So really raising the awareness of the industry, because the electronics industry is very broad. But most of the, as I like to say, a lot of the oxygen in the room gets sucked up by the semiconductor industry. Oh, we need to build the greatest, latest chips. And we agree with that wholeheartedly. But we also want to make sure there's the technology to put those chips to work in the rest of the electronic system. So we've been trying to educate the governments of the world about the ecosystem of the electronics world. And it's fairly complex. You know, people think about electronics. What do they think of? They think, oh, it's a chip and it's software. And that's all there is.
Right.
And there's so much more to it to connect everything together.
Or if you're like my mother, I'm in computers. You know, she'll tell her friends, what does your son do? He's in computers.
Right?
That's
exactly.
the kind of the press box view of electronics for a lot of people.
Yeah, so there's several issues. We work on environmental health and safety issues, obviously trying to make sure that we are bringing science-based regulations to bear on that. We work with them to try to help solve industry issues, like workforce issues right now has been a major focus for us. It's been an issue for our industry for, oh, I want to say 30 years, but we have been trying to leverage programs that the government can help us support to, again, help the industry get some perhaps financial support or additional programs that might allow them to do even more education as goes forward. So we tend to focus on, and then we work with various certifying bodies as well to, or bodies that are interested in certification to make sure that what we can bring in terms of assurance of the electronics supply chain is well-founded as well as verifiable.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
So lots of different things.
Yeah, for sure. So you worked in the electronics industry for some time before you joined IPC. You know, you're one of us, right? including jobs at General Electric Aerospace, Alpine Electronics, and Bose. Just before you joined IPC, you also served as a CEO of Golden Key International Honor Society with more than 2 million members in 190 countries. My gosh, I don't know how one can keep track of all that. And you memorized every member's name, from what I heard.
Every member's name. It was amazing.
You're a savant, yes. So I'm going to
Well, here with that group, once you join, you're a member for life, no matter what you do. So it's like forever. So it's basically college students become members and then they're members for the rest of their life, or they have the opportunity to take advantage of the benefits.
It's like the Hotel California. You can check in anytime you like, but you can never leave.
You can never check out.
Maybe IPC should do that. Members for life. Well, just, I guess you'd have to have a way of picking their pocket every month. So,
you know, some of our members have been members for over 60 years. So some
amazing.
Of them feel like it's been for life. It's great.
Well, IPC started in the '50s, right? 55
yeah,
or 57. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's been around a long time before electronics were really the electronics we know today. So giving you a chance to kind of take a bow a little bit, how has each of these experiences in your former life contributed to your success at IPC, and how has your combined experience benefited IPC in general. Now, you're not applying for a job. You already have it. but it is reassuring to me to know that the person behind our largest trade association actually came out of our industry. So tell me how some of that experience has benefited you and IPC.
Well, you know, people, especially my kids, are like, so what do you do, Dad? Everything I've done throughout my career, it's this position at IPC is like the juxtaposition of my entire career. I started off as an electrical engineer working for GE Aerospace, you know, doing some really cool design. I was actually doing board layout on a Mentor graphics on an old Apollo systems, you know. So, and back then we thought an 8-layer board was amazingly huge, you know. It was just like, oh, wow, 8 layers, that's crazy, you know. We have to have ground planes and vias and, you know, it was like exciting.
Sure.
And that was late-breaking technology back then for us. And then I moved into the automotive section, did some more design, got involved with software. That was kind of my shift into international at working for Alpine and Bose. I did worked a lot in the automotive space, where right now, you know, the electronics in vehicles is just exploding. And so having experienced some of the early going phases of that from, you know, building the 1992, if you ever drove a 1992 Honda Civic, that was my radio. I made that thing, you know. It was kind of fun.
The John Mitchell special.
Exactly, a John Mitchell special. I don't even know those things are still running, but I wish I still had one sitting around here somewhere. But so I got exposure to automotive electronics at Bose and Alpine. And then as I moved into Golden Key, that was my first foray into the nonprofit world. And so the way you operate in a nonprofit world is slightly different than a for-profit world, but not totally different. So I brought my for-profit experience to nonprofit and then turned around. And at that point, I also got my doctorate in education, which also leveraged this. So if you look at my career, you've got electrical engineering. I got my MBA. I had international experience. I've got nonprofit experience, and I've done the education spot. And that's everything that we're doing here at IPC.
Sure.
You know, from education to electrical engineering to business to international to nonprofit. So it's like the perfect storm for me from a career perspective. And so it keeps me interested in literally every part of the organization. Probably the biggest gap I had coming in here was in the advocacy side. I didn't have much experience there, which is great because it's another area that I can learn and add to my experience.
Sure.
I've relied heavily on our partners in DC and Brussels and Beijing to help educate me about the path forward. And I've been learning a lot these past 8 years.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I wasn't planning on going down this road, but let me ask you a quick question. You brought up auto, and obviously that is a huge part of the growth of the electronics industry. We talk about IoT, Internet of Things, 4.0, Industry 4.0, automotive. We seem to be bringing in a lot of life into the electronics industry. In fact, I read recently that up to 30% of the bill of materials cost of an automobile is in the electronics, which is crazy.
By 2030, it's supposed to be over 50%.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, with the electrification of cars, we are driving, you know, computers and camera systems and all the stuff that, you know, happens to have seats in it and a steering wheel, which we may not even need a steering wheel in the short-term future.
I don't go into looking at a car to wonder how much horsepower it has anymore. I go in to understand how well my gadgets are going to work in the vehicle and what kind of cool tech is in there. I mean, it's the selling point now, as opposed to, you know, will the car start up? And, you know, I mean, I'm sure at the high performance and you still want to know how fast it goes 0 to 60. But in most people's cars, it's like, will it integrate with my mobile device?
That's right. It's very rare that I take a car in for service today, because I have both a Japanese car and an American car, two American cars. And, you know, the stereotypical thinking back in the day was, if you buy an American car, you're going to, you know, get to know the dealership quite well. The only time I've taken my cars into the dealer for any type of service is due to an electronic issue, not a mechanical issue. You know, they got that down. My like you said, my phone won't pair in under 5 minutes or something, or my XM radio is not working properly, or my I had to take it in
once. My sensor's not working, my camera doesn't turn on, or something.
Yeah, my adaptive cruise control stopped working, and I had to take that in. And you know, I can still drive the car just fine, but I had to do a little bit more work. So yeah, that's a big growth sector within our industry. Is IPC bringing in the auto manufacturers? I think for a long time, I realize I just asked a question and now I'm rambling on, but let me qualify the question. For a long time, it seems to me, and I'm not an expert in the automobile industry, but it just seemed to me that the auto industry always considered themselves to be an auto industry. They are a mechanical industry. They're sheet metal, they're engines, they're welding, and they throw electronics in. And when Tesla came on the scene, Tesla did not consider themselves an auto company. They considered themselves a tech company that happened to be building autos. They just came in from a different angle. Is the auto industry now considering themselves also an electronics industry, and are they adopting IPC standards, or are they participating in the IPC movement to create standards specifically for their industry, or you know, what's their relationship with IPC?
Yeah, so when I first joined IPC, I understand prior to that time, there had been forays to try to reach out to the automotive industry, as you say, and they were less than successful. However, recently, it's been very successful. There is a mutual interest. We're able to leverage a lot of the experience in the high reliability markets, you know, in terms of aerospace, space, military. A lot of this reliability of electronics applies perfectly to automobiles. And so instead of them having to have all these complex systems that are suddenly subject to were meant for consumers but are subject to harsh conditions, they're partnering up with us. They are participating in standards. They're helping create iterations of our standards that are focused just on automotive. So there's addendums that are focused on the automobile. And so we've been very excited that globally we've got interest from Asia automotive manufacturers, European automotive manufacturers, and North American automotive manufacturers. So they're all getting involved, and their suppliers are as well. So that has been good news. And I think it's good news for the automotive industry as well, the consumer, because your electronics will work more reliably going forward.
Yeah, and we need it to, because I'd said this in another podcast, but we now rely on the electronics to keep us safe. It's gone from infotainment and gadgets and, you know, stuff like that to real critical systems. And
Safety systems.
Yeah. I don't look over my shoulder anymore. I trust the blind spot indicator. My foot doesn't hover over the brake as I'm approaching slowing traffic anymore, as it used to, because I now rely on my adaptive cruise control to brake for me when it needs to. So, you know, I'm a worse driver today. I've said this in other episodes. I'm a worse driver today because I'm relying on the technology. And unlike the aircraft industry, we don't have three other or two other redundant systems. You know, all this stuff has to work. And, you know, we can't put backup redundant systems as we do in other safety-related parts of other transportation means like aircraft. So we're taking all this stuff out into harsh environments. So, yeah, we've been through this before. IPC has been through this before. So it's good that the auto industry is not trying to reinvent the wheel. You know, take what's best from the IPC standards, adapt it to what's unique about electronics, and create either an addendum, or maybe it's going to be class 1, 2, 3A for automotive or something. But it's going to be interesting to see how that shakes out to me.
Yeah, it will be interesting. You mentioned the redundant systems piece, and I imagine at some point there will be systems that will need to be made redundant in the vehicles, but we'll see.
Yeah. Well, it is. We're watching history being made right now, I think. So let's talk about something quite topical, which is the COVID-19, also known as the coronavirus. You know, it started off as a problem in a faraway country, albeit a strategic country for our industry, in a sense now spread across the world. In fact, this morning I read that China is now seeing imported cases of the coronavirus. It's coming back, you know, from visitors to China coming in. So the general public is experiencing trouble purchasing toilet paper, water, face respirators, sanitizers, things like that. Things that I don't quite understand. But anyway, Our local Costco in the town I live in was just on the national news because the police had to be called because they were rioting over toilet paper and water. So that's in the civilian world. And I've seen in the civilian world many examples of price gouging and hoarding. We have to buy respirators at our company because we weld equipment and, you know, there's certain things we do that require just face masks. And we can't buy any. And I've seen Amazon face mask, a single 3M face mask, go for $300, or at least try and go for $300, when you can normally buy 10 for $30. So in the civilian world, we're seeing a shortage of products and kind of panics and hoarding and things like that. How has that come down to the electronics world? And what is our industry doing about this? And are we about to see the equivalent of toilet paper hoarders in the electronics world with components and other things?
So that's a great question. Even from the early days back when this was hitting in January or hitting in mass in January across China, I was being asked the same kind of question. And we know a little bit more now, but not a lot more, you know, in terms of how to approach the infections there. But what the impact we're seeing on the industry. So we've been doing the a study, and we've it's like a rolling every couple of weeks. We're pinging the industry, and around the end of February, the view, or I guess it was mid end of February, the view from the industry was that they were being told there was going to be around a 3-week delay on average for them to get their parts in the supply chain. But when we asked them, okay, that's what you're being told, what do you think it is? They said, yeah, we probably think it's more like 5 weeks. So there's an impact there just on supply chain. And we're about to update that study again here this week. And so we will, as those results come in this week, there'll be another version. And we're going to be tracking the trends. Is it going up? Is it coming down, et cetera? But to me, the challenge is that there are ripple-on effects. So yes, there are parts that people are going to struggle getting as, you know, the delays in getting factories up to full bore. Even before this was happening, you know, for certain parts, there were very long delay cycles anyway that were causing some challenges. And so this has just enhanced those. But the other effect that nobody's really seems to be talking about is, so you have a key partner in the electronics supply chain of China, and now many of the world being affected. If, you know, while people said, okay, while production may have stopped for a couple of weeks, we kind of anticipated some of that with China's New Year shutdown, that will impact the flow of parts into the system. But the other part that we're not talking about is, okay, there were a lot of trips that didn't happen that were scheduled as well in terms of, oh, we need to have a discussion about a new product introduction, or if they end up shifting supply chains as well. So I imagine there will be some ripple-on effects that happen later throughout the year as well. So if you didn't, if you've suddenly stopped design on a program, a new program that you're planning on launching for the last 6 weeks because of travel, and you needed to go approve a site or a factory to build something or to go through the design of manufacturing, that won't hit you for another 6 or 8 months, depending on the product. And so you may see another kind of impact at that point as well. And so I think this is going to cause some uneasiness in the supply chain. We've seen some companies even announce that, look, hey, if you have a problem with this product and you need a replacement, it may be 4 or 5 weeks. And so that also, when we saw that, it came out about a week or so after our first study, we were like, yeah, it looks like that company's at least is consistent with the data that we collected.
Sure.
So it's a challenging thing to the entire supply chain, because right now, where do you go to get the stuff, right? It was already, as I mentioned before, it was already difficult to find certain components, and now it becomes more difficult. With regards to hoarding, I don't know that that's going to be terribly possible.
It's not enough to hoard.
Exactly. But you know, hopefully we'll act a little bit more sane than the grocery store rushes that you
right,
might find.
Right, the consumers at Costco.
You know?
Sure.
I mean, I hope that we can get a little bit away from the fearfulness around this and start looking at the actual data and the facts, you know, to, you know, do the right things, take care of ourselves, and then hopefully business can get back to full swing very soon in a safe fashion.
Sure. I tell my friends, we want to be cautious, not crazy. And
yes, that's right.
And there's sometimes a fine line between those. Speaking of cautious or crazy, I'm glad we've already had Apex, because Apex, this thing was just blooming when Apex in San Diego.
Yeah, our timing
happened.
Was fortunate there.
Yeah. I only saw a few empty booths, which were, you know, the, you know, Chinese electronics delegations and things like that. Those booths were empty. But for the most part, though, I mean, it was a full show. Everyone was traveling and participating. It's going to be interesting, and I'm not going to ask for a prediction, because I think it would be careless to ask for a prediction at this early in the game, but it will be interesting to see how industry events and meetings and things like that will or will not be affected by this. I know South by Southwest, the big music and tech thing in Austin, shut down. That wasn't so much, I think, for concern of coronavirus spreading. I think it was the fact that they just weren't selling a lot of tickets because people were afraid to travel. It was more of an economic decision than a safety decision. But it's going to be interesting to see, and I'm sure your teams are thinking about that, at least, about, you know, what happens if this thing keeps going, and, you know, how will we meet virtually, maybe, or in other ways or other locations. And I'm sure that is kind of a work in progress right now, you know, with plan A, plan B, plan C, all of that.
Yeah, I mean, as you know, a lot of what IPC does, we do virtually anyway. And so the important work will continue, which is good in terms of work on standards, work on education, and, you know, advocacy work. And people where they are can go together. We did cancel our Impact event, which was scheduled to be at the end of March, just out of caution and helping everybody feel comfortable. But that was a smaller event. It's really, you know, presidents, CEOs, executives coming in to meet with Congress members and administration folks. But we'll do something to shore that up at a later date. I saw that, you know, Productronica in Shanghai, they moved their event from March until July. So some of them are moving, some of them are canceling. They're like the big cell phone conference they did out of an abundance of caution, because they had like 200 countries all planning to come into their event in Europe. And they just said, hey, that's just too risky. And that was, that's over $100 million event that they just said, we're not going to have. And that'll wake anybody, any association up.
Absolutely.
You know, I'm hopeful that, you know, it will become a place where we sit there and go, okay, look, as long as I'm washing my hands, you know, as I normally do. And that, to me, that's been the one consistent advice that I've seen everywhere, from the CDC to government locations. It's like, hey, wash your hands.
Right. Which our moms all told us that anyway, when we were young. Right.
Exactly.
And so, yeah, that's always a good idea. This, you know, there's always silver linings that come out of things, not to minimize the impact of what this is. But I think some of the silver linings will be, we'll all learn to wash our hands more frequently. Second, I think people will come up with plan Bs. I've seen U.S. board manufacturers even advertise the fact that, hey, buy from us. We're not there. We're here. Now that's kind of changing because, you know, the virus is spread everywhere,
Well.
Right? It's not exclusively in one country, but
I think
for a while.
It's 107 different countries now.
Yeah, exactly.
Like
so if you had boards made in Northern Italy, you know, you're stuck now. So, I think it is a kind of a wake up call to some that diversification of suppliers is probably a good idea. You know, the reason the military type companies, the prime contractors, you know, all have manufacturing facilities throughout several states is so that if they annoy a senator or a congressman from that state, they have plenty of other congressmen and senators they can rely on and to support their activities in other states. They diversify the risk of being, you know, put out of business or something through a political climate. And I think the same will happen with manufacturing too. This is kind of a wake-up call that, you know, we put all our eggs in one basket, and if that basket is fractured or threatened somehow, you know, so are all our eggs. So I think we can take away a lot from this, and you know, maybe knowing that this will just continue to happen, you know, in the future. One, if it's not the coronavirus, it'll be a different type of coronavirus or a different, you know, SARS, MERS, whatever, bird flu. We've gone through this before, and this one seems to be impacting the world a little bit faster and greater. So, you know, maybe there'll be some takeaways from this that will benefit us if this happens again, hopefully.
Yeah, I like to look at the positive, you know. Hopefully we'll, just like you said, we'll come out on the other side better, stronger, faster.
Absolutely. Right? Now, for this question, I'm going to ask you for two answers, and it's a pretty short question. What, in your view, is the state of our industry today, short term, and long term?
So, short term, the state of the industry is very good, notwithstanding the coronavirus issues that are disrupting a little bit of the supply chain. So, it's still very strong. We were worried a little bit with some of the trade and tariff wars going on, how that might impact things. But other than the coronavirus, things are actually good. In the future, it's amazing. I mean, every industry in every country, in every profession you can imagine, is using electronics. And that's just increasing. So the opportunities for new products, for advancement, and to leverage a lot of this new, you know, from AI to 3D printing to robotics, a lot of these things, they're already in our factories. And so we're on the leading edge of the future here, you know, in terms of just about every major technology you can imagine. We're either creating it, and after we've created it, we're one of the first people to use it. And so I'm very excited about where it's going. The electronics industry, as a rule of thumb, basically grows twice as fast as GDP. Mm. And so that's not a bad industry to be in.
Yeah, I agree. I think we're a very omnipresent industry, particularly today. And I, you know, we always go back and forth between revolution and evolution. Are we in a revolutionary time? Are we in an evolutionary time? I think we're a little bit of both. I do see some revolution, and I do see an awful lot of evolution going on in our industry. And I think it is going to explode. That we expect electronics to be omnipresent, and they are. Electronics is almost by a rule now omnipresent. You can't look more than a few feet in any direction without having some form of electronic device influence you and keep you safe or take you places or entertain you or whatever the case may be. It's everywhere. So,
yeah,
one of the challenges I see, which obviously will be overcome, is what I've talked about on the show before as the silver tsunami, the people who
we call it the great tsunami, but yeah.
I love it. Yes, yes, exactly. So the tsunami of the old sages, the wise old men and women that know where all the process skeletons are buried, that are product, subject matter experts, are all leaving because, you know, they're all retiring now. I am beginning to see the light on younger men and women coming into our industry. But for a long time, there was an absence. There was a huge generation gap within our industry. What's IPC doing to attract younger engineers, technicians, managers into our industry?
So this is an area we've been concerned about for some time. This is not a new problem. I'm just grateful that a lot of our industry, that great tsunami, is living longer and healthier. So they're not retiring as fast as they might, or even after they retire, they still stay involved because they're very active, which is great. But in an effort to bring younger engineers, there's several things we're doing. First, last year, we refreshed the education, IPC's Education Foundation, and established it as a 501c3. And the mission of that is to bring new folks into the workforce. All right. And they're focused on high school and universities and a little bit into middle school as well, in trying to create or overcome perceptions issues that they might have that sit there and go, oh, well, you know, I don't do it. You know, is this really somewhere I want to go? We're creating pathways as well as helping prepare them. So those are kind of the three P's. And we do that through chapters and competitions and career fairs and things like that. And so there is an effort that IPC is investing in on behalf of the industry to help really bring in that new talent and to help them be successful in this industry. As we talked, separate from that, or it also leverages this, is that education area that we talked about. As we work with the JTAs, we're trying to understand what the gaps are and how can we bring people literally with no experience to get them involved. We worked with a company called, it was L3 at the time, now it's L3 Harris. And they wanted to use some of IPC's education materials in combination with a local community college. And they took people right off the street. It was right after the Great Recession in 08 and 09. And they took people out of the food service industry. They took people out of the banking industry. And they ran them through a program for just a few weeks. And those people today now are program managers, project leads, and they're contributing to the industry when they, initially they had no background whatsoever. And so we continue to outreach to them. Another program that we have, sorry, I've got a lot on this stuff. You can tell I'm a little bit excited about
it.
I love it.
Yeah, I love it. You go.
The Emerging Engineer program, we started about, I think this is our fourth year of doing it. It started off with two or three engineers, and we've had three or four. And we challenged the group this year, said, can we get more than just three or four people to program with this, to work with this? And they basically, you get a newer engineer or a student in university coupled with a mentor.
I signed up for that. I am a first year mentor. My mentee at the show at IPC Apex Expo.
So we had 30 this year. So we 10x'd it, which is amazing. And I'm hoping we can do the same, hoping we can double that number again and maybe even have 60. I joked with them. I said, if we keep this up, we're going to have a separate luncheon just for the emerging engineers because we'll have so many engaged.
You're going to need a bigger stage.
But as you looked around Apex, there were younger people there. Yeah. And I was like, this is great. This is exactly what we need. Get people engaged in the industry and in the education and the standards and in the exhibition, et cetera. So
yeah, when I went to the emerging engineer cocktail thing or whatever, the soiree, whatever you want to call it. I was amazed. I'm like, where'd you all come from? Cause I hadn't seen them until I started looking for them, and then they're there. So clearly the problem will obviously fix itself when no one comes to work. You know, there'll be a huge, demand for people, but, it does seem to be, growing that I see. And I'm really glad that it's growing in terms of gender. I'm seeing, when I was at the event, I was seeing a healthy mix of men and women, young men and young women that I hadn't seen before. Because this has been kind of an old, man industry for so many years that it's very refreshing to see young men and women coming into our industry, not just one gender.
What? I had someone who asked me about that from a press group, and they said, so you're trying to find new jobs, and aren't you just looking for 40-year-old white men to go work in the factories? I said, have you been in one of these factories lately? That is not who's working in these factories.
That's very true.
And so I went around, and in Thailand, 98% women, 98.
Yeah.
It was amazing to me. They actually, as we toured that factory, it was funny. They said, yeah, we actually got smart about this. We ended up converting 70% of the men's restrooms to women's restrooms. Now there's just two men's restrooms because we just don't need that many. We don't need an equal number.
Right.
It was just fascinating. The aspects of that. So again, that diversity, I think, is just going to help the industry.
As Bob Dylan sang in 1964, the times, they are a-changing, and it's nice to see them changing toward this direction that we see right now. Let's talk about trade wars. We're going to only a couple more questions here, and then you can get back to solving all the problems of the world, which there are many. Let's talk about trade wars for a moment. I personally, again, I don't get political on this show, but I just think, generally speaking, trade wars are usually bad for the industry because one country has a beef with the other, they put up tariffs or some other type of restriction, and then the other country just counters with an equal amount or more, and then it goes back and forth, and it doesn't really do the industry a whole lot of good in the long term. But do you see light at the end of the tunnel with our current tariff situation and trade war situation between us and several other countries and one country in particular?
I see hope. One of the things that we've been very active on the advocacy front, you're asking what issues. So this is one of the areas we've been very active on all fronts across the globe. basically saying, we believe in free, fair, rules-based trade. Okay. And if someone that you're a trading partner or somebody you're trading with is breaking the rules, go work on resolution to that rule. Don't use tariffs to try to solve that, because it's tariffs are not the problem. They're, I think I was quoted last year as saying, using tariffs to solve the trade problem is like using a sledgehammer to make orange juice.
Yes.
It'll get the job done, but there's a lot of collateral damage.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I think it's
an
overreaction.
And so we're trying to avoid the collateral damage.
Yeah, it's a huge punishment. It is a, speak softly, carry big stick. This is a big stick that we're using.
Yeah, and exactly.
I don't think there's enough speaking softly going on. I think it's just kind of and I do believe it is something that needs to be fixed, though. I mean, I do agree with the premise of, hey, we need a level playing field. I get that part. I just think that I'm in total agreement with what you just said in terms of, We're fixing it with a lot of collateral damage, and the collateral damage is
the World Trade Organization, WTO, mm-hmm. I believe really needed to step up, or needs to step up show a little bit more teeth. But the countries involved with the WTO also have to give them the power to use those teeth to rectify some of these whatever unfair practices, whichever country may have grievances with any other country, say, okay, this is the adjudicating body when it's inter-country issues, and let's give them the power to actually act on that.
Before I ask you the most important question ever asked of an IPC CEO, before I ask you that one, drum roll, here's a question just before that. What are, in your view, the most challenging issues for our industry, and what is the greatest opportunity for our industry?
The speed of change. And that affects everything. It's challenging and it's a great opportunity. First, we're used to it, okay? The electronics have been changing fast forever, right? I mean, you think about it. There's new technology coming out every few months in some devices that, if you have tech envy, you're constantly changing your phone or whatever device it may be just to make sure you've got the latest, greatest, what have you.
Sure.
So that presents challenges, because in some industries, think about the automotive industry where I came from. How do you keep up with that? The interface. Now there are some great interfaces that are allowing for some of that advancement to be leveraged within the vehicle, even, because you have a 5-year development cycle, 4 to 5 years development cycle for most vehicles. And you've probably had 8 different models of phones that have been developed from the time you thought of your design to the time you launched it. And then you'll have another 20 over the lifetime of the vehicle. So how do you keep up with that? So that's a challenge, but we're smart. We'll figure it out. And so, putting blank screens that you can plug a phone into or connect a phone to, that all of a sudden you get all the advantages of the speed of the phone showing up on a big display that works for your car. That's one solution. So the speed of change, the other aspect that the speed of change affects is, of course, trying to keep up with the knowledge. And so that's why we're focused on education and standards, to try to make sure that we can keep the industry up to speed and bring the incoming industry in the best prepared way as we can. So I think the speed of change affects a lot of what's going on with our industry, but we're also the cause of a lot of that change as well. So we better be ready for it.
I love it when one answer serves both. What's the biggest challenge? Speed of change. What's the greatest opportunity? Speed of change.
Speed of change.
You're right. It is a revolving door. It's a problem and a solution and an opportunity all in one. So the last question I have, the big drum roll question. When IPC started in 1957. I'm assuming IPC was an acronym. What the heck does IPC, or what did it stand for? As an acronym? I've had so many people ask me, IPC is International Printed Circuits. And whenever I've asked the question, not of you, but in the many years ago, I would always get, it doesn't stand for anything. It's just a name. But I have to assume at some point in its history, IPC had a meaning in its name. Do you know what that is, or is it the world's best kept secret?
I do know.
All right.
Back in 1957, we were formed as the Institute of Printed Circuits.
Oh.
IPC.
That makes too much sense.
And there were six printed circuit board companies that were members that started it off, and that's why it was the Institute of Printed Circuits. The challenge was, as time progressed, it wasn't just printed circuit companies anymore. Then they added the suppliers. Then we added the EMS companies, then the OEMs, and all the suppliers that go into that. So being just the Institute of Printed Circuits really didn't make any sense. So it really doesn't stand for anything right now. The company official name is IPC International Incorporated. Okay, so it's IPC International, and we go by IPC. And you know, we just literally updated our tagline, which is build electronics better, because that's what we help the industry do. You know, so you'll see in a lot of our branding now, if you go out to the website, you'll just see IPC, build electronics better, so that if people want to know, you know, what is IPC? What did we do? We help the industry build electronics better.
Well, I was going to suggest you change it to IPCAEE, which would be International Printed Circuits and Everyone Else. But I think your plan is better.
Thank you.
Yes.
I hope it works out.
I think it will. John Mitchell, thank you so much for being my guest today. I really appreciate the last
it's a pleasure, Mike. Thank
50
you.
Minutes or so that you've taken out of your day. And I appreciate your work and what you do for our industry and what IPC does for our industry. I've seen a lot of little shifts lately with some staffing. You brought on some people I know that are pretty cool. I think will be great for the industry. I'm thinking of Matt Kelly specifically, Brooke Sandy.
Yeah, our new chief technologist. We've got a new chief economist with Sean Dubrovac. And we're trying to do what we can to help the industry be even more successful.
Yeah, well, keep up that good work, and thanks for being my guest. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, that's another episode. Thanks for joining me. If you like what you hear, be sure and press the subscribe button so you'll be notified every time a new episode is available. Please continue to send your comments and suggestions. You can reach me at mike@mikeconrad.com. That's Conrad with a K. This podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and most anywhere you get your podcasts. A special thanks to the folks at Ascendo Reliability and Circuits Assembly's PCB Chat, both whom syndicate this and other podcasts at reliability.fm and pcbchat.com. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with another episode of Reliability Matters. In the meantime, keep doing it right.
Thanks for listening to the Reliability Matters podcast. Join us on the second and fourth Tuesday of each month for new episodes of Reliability Matters.